So I wanted to do one example that we'll use again of a differential cross section, so I'll sketch it. So the philosophy I have with computations is 99% of the time I'll do it all for you, except when it's complete, when it's sort of just an algebraic step that involves canceling a bunch of terms or multiplying a bunch of terms. If I do all of those, it'll take too long. And sometimes the calculation's so long that I have to actually leave some things out, and then I'll have it either as a homework or some other situation where you fill it in. So the idea is that everything, one way or another, will be explicitly worked out in the class. Of course, that limits the number of things we can do, but I always like classes like that, so that's the way this one's going to be. Okay, so we had this formula. For 2-to-2 scattering in the center mass frame. And so this was A coming in with a magnitude of 3 momentum equal to PA, and B coming in the center of mass frame, and out goes 1 and 2, and this is the magnitude of the momentum of particle 1, and because we're doing the case where MA equals, I think we, did I set the masses were equal for this, or did I do it in general? Yeah, I set it equal. Yeah. So this was the case where MA equals MB. And of course, this matrix element, unlike the decay case, it could depend on this angle, theta. And so to get the total cross-section, you have to integrate over this solid angle, the solid angle d omega. So this is the solid angle of particle 1, if you'd like. D omega is d cos theta d phi. And this doesn't depend on phi by rotational invariance, and so that integration just gives you a 2 pi. And you'll excuse me for a second while I tie up my shoe so I don't fall down in the middle of the class and hit my head, be unable to lecture. Okay, so I wanted to do one example in class, and so the example I'm going to do is E plus E minus goes to mu plus mu minus. So the muon is a particle like the electron. It's about 200 times heavier, has the same electromagnetic charge. It's kind of an unfortunate thing in the standard model for particle physics that everything gets replicated 3 times, more or less, as far as the spin a half particles are concerned, and nobody really understands why that's the case. There's been a lot of papers written on why and trying to understand the masses of the particles, but more or less, we haven't gotten anywhere in, I don't know, 30 years of thinking about this problem. So if you want to pick a problem to work on for your PhD thesis in particle physics and ensure that you won't graduate, this is the one. There's a couple of others like that. Well, you know, maybe you'll hit the, you'll understand it or something. But okay, so there's one Feynman diagram, E minus, I'll label that momentum K1, that's the electron coming in. You pick the direction of the arrow for the antiparticle as going out, even though the antiparticle momentum is flowing in. And then it couples to the photon, and the momentum transfer, or the momentum flowing through this line, is just K1 plus K2. And the photon rematerializes as the muon mu minus, and I gave that a momentum P1 in my labeling, and the mu plus I call P2. It's also outgoing, but because it's the antiparticle, you draw the arrow like that. And then you use the Feynman rules for electrodynamics. So the Feynman rules for electrodynamics is basically only one vertex, which is this. And depending on your convention, it's either minus I E, well, I think mine's actually plus I E gamma mu, where this is one of the Dirac gamma matrices at this vertex. So we can write down the matrix element, the invariant matrix element, the thing that goes into into the formula for the cross section here, the differential cross section, just by putting together the Feynman rules. The spinners on the outside for these lines, the propagator for the photon, the factors at the vertices. So you've done this a few times before, I presume. We're going to do it one more time, just for fun. You having fun? Not yet. Wait, when I write it out, it'll be more fun. I'm having fun. So I'm going to be a little sloppy in this class. Is it M or should I write IM? I don't care. In the end, I'm taking the absolute value square. Different people use different conventions. I'll probably be totally inconsistent in this class, sometimes putting the I, sometimes not. You know, in life, you got to spend your time caring about the things that really matter. That phase doesn't matter. Pretty deep philosophy, don't you think? Yeah. Well, that's a reason why I never passed any philosophy classes. But anyways, here we go. So what do? You take the end of the arrow, the end of the line, and you run backwards. Try it. You'll fall down. But not in this case. So there's the spinner for the antiparticle. That's a V. There's the gamma mu. There. There's the spinner on this end for the particle, U of K1. Those are all electrons. And the indices are all contracted. This is a matrix. This is a column vector. And I haven't written out the indices. It's matrix multiplication. So this is V dagger gamma naught. And so you could view this as a row vector. This is the column vector. This is the matrix. Got it? So we don't write down the indices here. They're implicit. And I put the square brackets here to note that they're all contracted here. There's no leftover indices. Any questions? Yes?
Do we just not care about spins at the moment?
Well, I've suppressed that label. We will care about it. But I've just suppressed the label. They all have different spin labels. I got to suppress as much as I can.
Would you mind?
I haven't finished yet, if that's the question. But if not, would I mind what?
So when you do the contraction, what is this?
This is a four-component object, so it has an index. And this is a 4x4 matrix, so it's beta alpha, and this is beta. And it's summed over alpha and beta from 1 to 4. Okay, so that's what I mean. But we're going to leave them off. You can actually, sometimes it pays to be more explicit. It's because if you have too slick a notation, then you fool yourself into thinking you understand things. But if you write down too many things, then you get confused. So it's a little bit of a trade-off there. Like here, you want to know what general relativity is? It's root gr. OK, we're done. So there's a lot hidden in the notation sometimes. OK, so that's part of it. And then there's the propagator for the photon. Just keep asking me the questions. It's important that you understand. That's what I get the big bucks for. I don't think I get any bucks. Anyways, let's go on. This is the propagator for the photon. I've made a gauge choice in the propagator for the photon there. You have to choose a gauge, as many different gauges you can pick. Which gauge did I pick? Anybody know? Wait. I can give away cat. Oh, I got this thing in my pocket. I can't get the money out. This recording thing is... Okay. What gauge is that? Sorry, I wasn't looking. Anybody put their hand up? Okay, who said it? I couldn't see. Yeah, that's Feynman gauge. Here. Oh, wow. Look at that toss. Oh, that was my fault. I'll get better at it. Yeah, that's Feynman gauge. Why did I use Feynman gauge? Well, it's the easiest gauge to use. Plus, look at this shirt. I'm from Caltech. I get a small pay raise every time I mention Feynman's name, and now it's recorded, so I can send it back. So I got to use Feynman gauge. And then we got the second part of the diagram. So it's U bar of P1, IE gamma nu, and then V of P P2. And then these indices are contracted in the same way, so we close the bracket. So that's the invariant matrix element. Of course, these spinners, they depend on the momentum and the mass of the particle, so they're not the same as these because the masses are different, the momentum are different. And they depend on all the spins. It's 1, 2, 3, 4 separate spin labels. Okay? So what do we want to do? We want to take, let's just write M up to a phase. Let's pull out the E squared over Q squared. Let's, the eta mu nu just contracts the indices. Makes that an upper if you want. This is fun. I see. Hold on a second. I don't know what I'm doing with these boards, but it'll be okay. That's very useful, isn't it? I just covered up everything I wrote. You know what I could do? I could go across, right? You know, let me just spend the next 30 minutes playing with the board. Obviously, I shouldn't move. It doesn't matter. Oh, probably I can move this one up. Which one do you think this one is?
It's the last switch.
The rear? No, I can't. Okay, so this one, I think I got to bring the top one. So I got to bring the front one down. This will only take 20 minutes or so. Okay, so what do I want to do? I'm going to do a spin average cross section. So I want to calculate a quarter the absolute value of m squared. So if I want the absolute value of m squared, and I got to sum over all the spins, So the quarter is averaging over the initial spins. There's two of these, four all together, that's the quarter. So when I take the absolute value of m squared, I got to take, for example, each of these terms times their complex conjugate. But complex conjugating a structure like this is pretty easy because of the properties of the gamma matrices. All it does is take this over here, the bar here, and the gamma stays the same. That's how you complex conjugate it, if you know about a little bit about gamma matrices. And so if I put this all together, So what did I start with? I started with these two things. Then I write this out again using lambda so I don't get confused, and then I complex conjugate it. And so that gives me u bar of k1 gamma lambda v of k2. And V bar of P2 gamma lambda U of P1. So the main reason I'm doing this is to get to the point that I'm getting to right now, which teaches you how to handle the spins. So I wanted to remind you that, okay, so we got to take this, I got to sum over all the spins. And so I've got, let's say I sum over the spins of U of K, V, bless you, U bar of K. And this is, so now they depend on the spin S. Oh, how did I do the label? Did I put it up here last time? They depend on the spin S. And this is a matrix in the space alpha beta. So it ends up that this is p slash plus the mass of the particle here, alpha beta. And if I write the same formula with the sum with spinners, That's P slash minus M alpha beta. So look what happened in this formula. For this part here and this part here, I can use this formula. This part here just becomes a P slash plus M, and the matrix multiplication continues through because this index is contracted with this, this one with this. And similarly, this one with this one, I can represent by this, and what it does is convert the whole thing into a trace because of how the indices are contracted. And so what we're going to end up with is a factor of this here, a factor of this here, and the whole thing traced, and no more spinners. So that's the general method. And then you got traces, you got to know how to do traces. So I'm going to remind you how you do traces. Well, I guess I should write that formula. So 1/4 sum over spins. I'm also going to imagine that we're working at very high energies here, very high energies, much greater than the masses of the particles involved, the electron, the muon. They're pretty light on the scale of modern particle physics. And so in this formula, I'll just set the mass to 0. Yes?
That should be k on the right hand side.
Pardon?
Instead of p's, you should...
Oh, it should be k's. Yeah, thank you. Right, the momentum for the problem. So what am I going to get? I'm going to get gamma mu k slash gamma lambda. Oh, this is k1 slash k2 slash times trace gamma mu p2 slash gamma lambda p1 slash. Yep. Okay, we're almost done. Yes?
Just to clarify, so you have one sum over spins, right?
But all the spins. All four of them.
Oh, okay, so you're sort of like, it can be decomposed in the sum of the U spins and the V spins.
Right, four sums over each of the spins. And the 1/4 is because when you're calculating a cross-section, unpolarized cross-section, you can actually pick up particular spins initially in an experiment or observe spins finally. You don't have to always sum over spin. But when you sum over the initial ones, well, if you sum over all of them, let's call it unpolarized. When you do that, the initial ones are averaged over. The final ones are summed over. Okay, so we got to do this. So, I mean, there's various formulas for gamma matrices, but the one we would use here is something like A, B, C, D, C, you know my alphabet. So that's 4 A dot B, C dot D, plus A dot D, B dot C, minus A dot C, B dot D. Or if you want to write it out just in terms of the gamma matrices, so here A, B, C, D, and 4 vectors are, like if I have A slash, it's A mu, gamma mu. So, or you could write it like this. One, two, three, four, ecky ducky. That's 4 eta mu, lambda, eta sigma, delta, plus eta mu, delta, eta lambda, sigma, minus eta mu, delta, eta mu, sigma, minus eta, lambda, delta. So if I use this, then we're essentially done. We can then express all of it. So then we'll get a bunch of factors of momenta. They'll be contracted with each other. And we just write that out. I'll tell you what you get when you do that. There's a few steps, but they're straightforward and they're in my notes as well. So 1/4 the sum over all the spins, m squared becomes e squared over q squared squared 8 k1 dot p2 k2 dot p1 plus k1 dot p1 k2 dot p2. The next thing you do is you write out all the momenta explicitly in the center of mass frame. So here you go. Here's K2 for the E plus, and you could write that, since we're neglecting the mass, as E center mass over 2, 1, the massless part, and then it's going along the Z axis. And then here's the E minus, and that's K1, and that's E center mass over 2, 1, the minus the Z axis. Then out comes the muons. The mu minus is got momentum p1, e center of mass over 2, 1, some direction. I'll call that n hat, a unit vector, that, and then the antiparticle, mu plus momentum p2 is e center of mass. So you can just evaluate all the dot products. Let's just do one, for example. If I want to do k1 dot P1. What is that? So I take this K1, I'll get E center of mass squared over 4, and I'll get 1 plus, so there's a minus here, plus Z hat dot N hat, and that's just the angle between these two vectors. I'll just call that something. I'll call that cosine theta. So that's this, theta's this angle here. And so it becomes e centimeters squared over 4, 1 plus cos theta. And now you're done. You work on all the dot products in that way. You take this 1/4 m squared. That here I wrote it as m squared because there were no spins. Now we replace this by the 1/4 m squared, and we plug in that formula. It's all straightforward algebra at this point. I'll tell you what you get.
The E2 in the diagram, does that need a negative n hat?
Yes. Back to back, center mass frame. So what you get is that d sigma d omega is equal to 1 over 64 pi squared, the center mass energy squared, and you get e to the 4, 1 plus cos squared theta. And if I want sigma, I have to integrate, take 2 pi, integrate d cos theta. This is from the d phi integration, from minus 1 to 1. And usually people express the answer in terms of alpha. Alpha is e squared over 4 pi. Numerical value is sort of burned into the soul of every physicist, is 1 over 137. And so if you take the e's here and the pi's, you combine it to alpha, you get that the total cross section, sigma, is 4 pi over 3 alpha over e center of mass squared. So as you go to higher and higher energy, the cross section, this is rather inconvenient, isn't it? Should I move it up? So let's say you wanted to do another example like this. In physics, it's really important to be able to copy. You get full points for copying. Because in order to copy, you have to understand the physics that it applies. So let's do another situation. There's other kinds of particles. Yes?
It shouldn't be alpha squared.
Oh, absolutely. I wonder if that's wrong in my notes. Yeah, it's wrong in my notes. Pen. Jeez. Okay. So let's think of another situation. Another particle with charge. Well, of course, there's stuff like the proton. The proton's got charge. But fundamental particle, you've probably all heard about quarks. Have you heard about quarks yet? You know about quarks. Everyone knows about quarks. So quarks have charge. Like an up quark has charge 2/3. So we could do the same thing for an up quark. Forget the fact that the up quark's got strong interactions, which are horribly complicated. We'll learn how to handle that in a moment. If I want to do the up quark, I want to get the answer, I just copy. So I get a it's got charge 2/3 and not -1, so I'll get a factor of 2/3 squared, and it comes in 3 colors, so I'll get a factor of 3, and that's the answer for up quarks. You don't have to redo it every time. And we'll use that later on, it's very important. Yes?
You said an up quark, but in this example, we have to consider 4 particles, so which are the 4 particles?
Oh, still still E plus E minus coming in, and the up quarks coming out. And the reason I did that is the incoming particles are the ones you prepare in your accelerator. And so they tend to be stable particles. People talk about making a muon accelerator, but no one has yet. So you want long-lived particles to prepare them. So the incoming particles are always things like protons and electrons in practice. But that's limited by what's stable, not something any deeper than that. Although it's pretty deep that something is stable, I have to say. Okay, so that's sort of a mini review. Yeah?
Suppose you then scatter with the electron with a quark that's in a proton or something?
You could scatter electrons off protons. Accelerators of that type were made.
But will in that case the mass of the quark be important or the mass of the bound state it appears in?
Okay, well, if you do high enough energy scattering, the mass of the proton won't matter, and hence the mass of the quark. And we'll talk about later on where the mass of the proton comes from. It's actually not the mass of the quarks in it. They're only a few percent of the mass of the proton. It comes from strong interaction dynamics that gives it its mass. But yeah, there's other types of accelerators. There's electron-proton. There's proton-antiproton, not just proton-proton. Anything where you have stable particles, you can make, you can prepare them. Okay, so now we're going to start the standard model in earnest. Oh, I forgot to mention to everyone that. So my notes are on the website for the class. A few lectures ahead. The only problem is that they'll probably have errors in them. Because I prepared them, I derived the stuff, and then I go over the night before and I find a few errors, and then when I lecture the class, I find a few more errors, and if I distribute them after, they're a lot more pristine than before, but if you find it, some of you might find it useful to look at them ahead of time, so they're on there as they are. Okay, so now we got to go on and talk about the standard model. So we're going to start off with what are the particles in it, what are the Lagrangian, what are the particles in it, what's the Lagrangian, what's the principle that it's built upon. So it's built upon a principle of gauge invariance. So electromagnetism is built on a U1 gauge invariance, and then the gauge invariance is extended to a bigger group to build the standard model. Of course, historically, this is not how the standard model was built up. This is a completely non-historical approach to what the standard model is. But you know, you don't want the history. That's sort of a mishmash of things. So the gauge group is SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. So it's not a simple gauge group like SU5. This is a subgroup of SU5, for example. It's a simple gauge group. It's product groups. And for each of these groups, you have gauge bosons like the photon. And the number of gauge bosons is given by the number of generators of the group. So there's 1 for here, 3 for here, 8 for here. And this SU, and each of these groups has a separate coupling constant. We call this G, this G2, this G1, this G1. This is not electromagnetism, this U1. It's something called hypercharge. So I put a sub Y on here. I'll tell you where electromagnetism comes from shortly. And so there's nothing particularly nice about this, but this is the way it is. So if you have a gauge group, the gauge invariance means that the particles, the gauge bosons, the particles associated with the generators of the group, the photon in the case of electromagnetism, are massless. That's why the photon is massless. You can't write down a mass term for a photon that respects how it transforms under gauge transformations. We don't have massless particles for all massless gauge bosons for all of the generators here. In fact, we only got one, if I leave out the graviton. We only got the photon. Hell, what happened? You know, we had this fundamental principle gauge invariance, and it's supposed to make all these particles massless, and we don't see any massless ones. Well, that's a bad start. And we got different reasons for each of them. So here, in the SU3, it ends up that the SU3 interactions at low energies get very strong, and you have non-perturbative dynamics. That means that all the color charges are bound into states that are color neutral. So these massless gluons, we don't see them. We just see bound states of them that have no color charge, them with quarks. So they're not degrees of freedom that we see because they're bound up in bound states because of this complicated strong dynamics. It's much more complicated than electromagnetism. In electromagnetism, photons don't directly interact with themselves. You know why I said directly? Or at least classically they don't. Oh. Of course that's the right answer, but I want to know the mechanism by which they interact. So we could do it. Here, I'll give you a clue since you... Here's one Feynman vertex. Here's another Feynman vertex. And we could put them together. Have a quarter. We could put them together, right? And so you can get two photons scattering to two photons through Feynman diagrams like this, through quantum processes, even though there's no such four-photon Feynman rule directly in the from the Lagrangian. If for gluons, there's actually a vertex like this, directly in the Lagrangian. And this and other vertices cause the dynamics here to be very different from electromagnetism. So that's why we don't see the massless gluons. The reason we don't see the massless generators here is a different phenomena. It's one you're probably familiar with. It's the phenomena of spontaneous symmetry breaking. So when I say this is a symmetry of the theory, the Lagrangian is invariant under this. But when you go and observe things in nature, if the ground state of the theory is not invariant under the symmetry is not manifest. The theory looks like it doesn't have the symmetry. For example, you can consider a ferromagnet where you have spin-spin interactions. So they interact spin-dot-spin, so it's rotationally invariant, but the ground state could pick out all the spins aligned in a particular direction. So if you were a little ant walking around on the surface of the magnet and you could detect magnetic fields, it would no longer look rotationally invariant. There'd be a preferred direction. So similarly, we're going to set up the theory so that this symmetry here, the SU2 cross U1, is not a symmetry of the ground state, but we do want the ground state to respect some symmetry. We want it to respect the U1 of electromagnetism. So we say that this SU2 cross U1 is spontaneously broken to U1. You might say, well, can't I just factor these out? But it's not the same U1. This U1, as I'll show you, ends up living in a combination of this and this. So that's why these gauge bosons are massed. That's why we have massive gauge bosons. So we have massive gauge bosons, W plus minus and Z, the photons, and then we have the 8 gluons. And they are massless as as far as their fields are concerned, if you look at mass terms, but you don't see them in the states of the theory, because they're bound up into these bound states. So let's not focus on this part for the moment. Let's focus on the SU2 cross U1. Let's try to understand that a little bit more. It's kind of a peculiar thing, you have to admit. Okay. So if you have a symmetry that's spontaneously broken like this, you need an order parameter. You need something that gets a vacuum something that transforms under the symmetry, that gets a vacuum expectation value breaking the symmetry so that it's no longer invariant. So we add something to the theory that transforms in a way to break the symmetry. And of course we don't want to, okay, so let me go on from there. So we don't want to break Lorentz transformation, Lorentz invariance, right? As far as we know, Lorentz invariance is a good symmetry. Certainly don't want to break rotational invariance, right? That would just be off. Even angular momentum wouldn't be conserved. But we don't want to break Lorentz invariance. So the thing we want to get a vacuum expectation value, we want it to be a scalar under Lorentz transformations, the order parameter. So we have options. We could add a scalar field, a fundamental field that's an expectation value, or we could make a composite. We could combine two fermions, for example. Psi bar psi is a scalar made up of two fermions. Yes?
Sorry, why do we assume that Lorentz invariance should be preserved?
Because it implies certain things. Right? So for example, the rotational subgroup of Lorentz transformations, it's really an experiment. We do low-energy experiments. We observe all the things that special relativity predicts. So it ends up that it's hard to break Lorentz invariance, but from our perspective, it's just experiment. And then you could try to set limits. You could break it a little bit, and you could put limits, and people have done that. It's really experiment. We're guided by experiment in these type of things. So we have options. We can use composite fields or we can add scalars. Particle physicists, we spit on fundamental scalars. We hate fundamental scalars. You know, if you write one down, you got to go back to your office and cry. Nonetheless, the simplest way to set up the theory and the way Steve Weinberg did it was just to add a fundamental scalar. I don't know if he really believed that's how it worked. Maybe he just got lucky. But given the recent data, we see it seems to be that that's the way things are working, although the story's not completely told. So at some point, I'll tell you why we spit on fundamental scalars. If you ever find one walking around in perimeter, you can spit on it. They don't really walk, of course. They're not. Yes?
Two questions. When you say fundamental scalar, are you talking about a Lorentz scalar?
Yeah. So I'm adding to the theory something that transforms as a scalar under Lorentz transformations. You can make composite things that transform like that. That are okay. But a fundamental one has some issues, which I'll mention when I discuss renormalization.
Yep. So the difference between a fundamental scalar and a non-fundamental scalar?
So a non-fundamental scalar could be, you could have fermion fields, and you can combine them to make, like, if you have a fermion field psi, then you can make psi bar psi out of it, and this is a scalar operator, and it could create something out of the vacuum that has the quantum numbers of a scalar, a composite field, because it's not created by a fundamental field in the Lagrangian. You could have bound states, for example, that are, you know, E plus E minus.
When you say add it to the theory, do you mean add it to the Lagrangian?
So first, when you write down a Lagrangian, you decide two things for us. I'll tell you our philosophy. Our philosophy is, what is the gauge group? It's given to us by a higher authority. Are you there still? Okay. He left. But anyway, before leaving, he gave us this gauge symmetry. That's number one. That gives you the gauge invariants. It gives you the gauge bosons. Number two, I tell you what matter degrees of freedom there are in the theory. Other things that transform in particular ways under this gauge symmetry. Those other things have certain Lorentz transformations. They can be Lorentz scalars. They can be Lorentz spinners. They can be Lorentz four vectors. Actually, you can't really make four vectors. The four vectors all live in here, at least not in a simple way. So we're going to make our theory, based on this gauge group, and we're going to add some fermions, and we're going to add one scalar representation. And the scalar is more or less added to break down the symmetry in the way we want. Those degrees of freedom, the particular matter things we add, they're forced upon us by experiment. They're what we observe in nature. We made the particles, we've got to have the fields that create and destroy them. So they're just forced upon us. That's the way nature works. We don't really understand why it's that particular set right now. Okay, so we're focusing now on breaking the symmetry. We're adding the scalar. So here we go. This is courtesy of Steve Weinberg. He won the Nobel Prize for this. More or less just this step. I'm going to add something that has the following SU3. Usually when you write the quantum numbers, you write it like this. There's SU3, SU2, U1. So it has no color, so I'll write that as a 1. That's a singlet under color. It doesn't transform under color. Everybody understand what that means?
How about you explain?
Pardon?
How about you define this?
So something could transform. So when something transforms under SU3, you write the transformation as E to the I alpha A T A, where these are the generators. And then the thing that's transforming, what should I call it? N? So N would be a column vector. It would be N1, let's say N, and then under a transformation, it would transform like this under the gauge transformations. And these, for SU3, there's 8 of these, the 8 generators of the group. The lowest dimensional representation is the singlet representation where these matrices are 0. So it's one dimensional, and just put a 0 here, it doesn't transform. The next one is what's called the fundamental representation where these are 3x3 matrices. And that's called the 3 representation. There's also something called the 3 bar where it's basically minus the complex conjugate of these. And then there's higher dimensional representations. There's an 8 dimensional representation where you could write these as 8x8 matrices, but you usually don't write it that way. And it's a study, there's a sort of more or less a study of group theory that tells you how to make up these representations. And no, it's not really the, I'm assuming you know a little bit about this for the class. Not so much, the level that you need for this class, it's all in this one chapter of Peskin and Schroeder. So, was that the book you used for field theory before? Okay. So if you're not so familiar with it, we can you can come see me, we can go through that chapter, or, well, I'm hoping you saw a little bit of it. So here we go. So it doesn't transform under color. And under SU2, it's a doublet. So I'll call that a 2. And then I have to tell you what hypercharge it is. That's hypercharge is a U1. Oh, I put my convention sort of put a minus on how it transforms. It's just, that's the convention. So it has hypercharge a 1/2, it ends up. And we'll come back to that. We'll see why we want it to be a 1/2. It'll become more apparent to you why I chose these quantum numbers. But that's how I'm going to do it. Yes?
So you explained what you meant by transformations, representations of transformations, and dimensions of the representations. And you also mentioned color and hypercharge.
It's similar. Okay, we'll finish the question so I answer the right one.
What exactly do you mean by color and hypercharge?
So this group, this is the color group, the SU3. This is the hypercharge group, the U1. And this SU2 is sometimes called the weak gauge group. And I haven't yet shown you how electromagnetism comes out of all of this. I wrote this as charge plus 1, and this is neutral. That's what these, but I haven't showed you why yet, but I am going to show you. Yes?
Would you explain what 2 and 1
have? Okay, so this is what, this, even though it's not electromagnetic charge, it means that under under the hypercharge group, it transforms into e to the minus, there's a separate e to the minus I alpha a half, the charge. So that's what this a half means. And the 2 means it's a doublet under SU2, so it transfers as e to the minus I alpha a Pauli spin matrices, and my convention is to put a half there for the generators. So it tells you, and these are 2 by 2 matrices, so it's a two-dimensional representation. So it's kind of complicated that it's a product of 3 gauge groups, so I got to tell you how it transforms under each of them. But that's what I mean. Is that okay for everybody? It's kind of it's important you understand this, so I don't mind going over it. And you should certainly interrupt me when you don't understand something, because I assumed you knew something that, even if you saw it once for 35 seconds, you might not remember it. Okay, so it's not apparent to you right now why this is what I want to add, but we'll see that this is what works, what gives us the standard model. And maybe for a homework, we'll change some of the quantum numbers here and you'll see what goes wrong. I think that'd be a nice homework. So we're going to focus on the part of the Lagrangian involving this thing. And we're going to try to understand that first before we even talk about quarks and electrons, just the part of the Lagrangian involving this and the gauge bosons. So we've got to write out the Lagrangian, right? Well, now we've come to Lagrangians. We want the Lagrangian to be invariant under Lorentz transformations because we observe Lorentz invariants in nature. We want it to be invariant under this gauge group because this is what works, what corresponds to nature, the experiments we've done. We want the interactions to be local, because as far as we know, there's only local interactions. We have it seems to be the way you make up a Lagrangian that fits nature. And then we have an infinite number of possibilities. That's a big number. So we need a further organizational principle. And the organizational principle is the most powerful one in physics. You know what the most powerful principle in physics is? Dimensional analysis. We're going to use dimensional analysis to get down from an infinite number of terms to a few. That's power. So I got to go over dimensions a little bit. So let's start by writing down some terms that could occur in the Lagrangian. And so let's do that. So here's the Lagrangian, so it involves H. So this d mu is an ordinary derivative plus other stuff involving the gauge bosons. Just like in electromagnetism, it's called a covariant derivative. There's a covariant derivative d mu plus IE a mu. This is the generalization of that to the bigger gauge group. I'll write it out more explicitly later. The reason you introduce covariant derivatives for gauge transformations is that if H, for example, goes to a gauge transformation U times H, gauge transformations depend on space-time. So if I just have a derivative, then H transforms in a complicated way. D mu, this is d mu H, does not go to U d mu H, because the U gets differentiated. But the covariant derivatives introduce, so this is true. And then it's easy to make up invariants where the u cancels out. Because here you would get a u, and then when you take the dagger, you'd get a u dagger, and here you'd get a u, and u dagger u is equal to 1, because it's some unitary transformation in this gauge group. So that's why you introduce covariant derivatives. And then you've got what's called the potential, the thing involving no derivatives. And then, of course, this, and what I'm going to choose for v of h is this. And then there's plus dot, dot, dot. Well, let's look at this v of h. In order for it to be invariant under gauge transformations, I'm going to have to make it up in terms of h dagger h. So it could involve h dagger h linear, h dagger h squared. But here I've got 2 parameters. This is the most general combination of h dagger h and h dagger h squared, just written in this very suggestive form. in the dot, dot, dot could be something like h dagger h cubed. I didn't write that down. I could also form d mu h dagger d mu h and square it and put that in my Lagrangian, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Infinite number of possibilities. So we got to get that down to a few possibilities because, you know, infinity is a big number. So we got to do a little dimensional analysis to get this big number down to something more manageable. So these things, lambda, v, they're parameters. So far for parameters, we got lambda, v, g, g2, g1. We're already up to five parameters. So, you know, as you get more fundamental, you get less parameters, right? The standard model, very few physicists believe the standard model is the end of the story. First of all, it doesn't include quantum mechanical effects of gravity at all. If you want to do quantum gravity, there's a limited number of options where people know enough to know that it's consistent. Well, Barton will tell you about probably the only real candidate where enough things have been worked out to have a lot of confidence that it's consistent, string theory. But that's not the topic here. We're satisfied with having parameters and fitting those parameters to data. You know, how satisfied you are depends on how many parameters. If you got 7,000 parameters and you fit them to data, you're going to be depressed. You got, even with a lot of data, if you got 10, okay, maybe you're okay. So a little bit of a judgment call there. Okay, but what's going on here? Why didn't I write down these other ones like this? So now I'm going to tell you why. So we introduced this Higgs field. But I didn't tell you what's the dimension of the Higgs field. You really want to understand dimensions. Every parameter you introduce, you want to know what its dimensions are. Because we chose h bar and c equal to 1, everything's got dimensions of mass or energy equivalently. So let's figure out its dimensions. What's a dimensionless object? Of the physical constructs that we have, well, it's really the action is the most fundamental dimensionless construct that we make because it gives you the measure for it gives you the quantum mechanical amplitude. You have to square it to get probabilities, but it gives you quantum mechanical transition amplitudes. So the action S is a dimensionless quantity. So let's look at a piece of the action. So in this covariant derivative are the ordinary derivatives. So let's just look at a piece of the action involving those ordinary derivatives. This is a piece. There's a whole bunch of other stuff. So if I count dimensions, so I'll write the dimensions like this in a bracket, and it'll be mass to a power, or energy to a power, and the bracket on the quantity is just that power. Everybody understand? So the dimensions of the action are what? Zero, because it's dimensionless. It's e to the I s over h bar. We set h bar to 1. That's the Feynman thing. That's the Feynman amplitude. Well, really, Dirac understood that first. But nonetheless, we're giving full credit to Feynman. So zero here. What's zero equal to? Well, we got various. Oh, shoot. Geez, this is wrong. It's so wrong. I'm going to have to replace these notes on the web. That's the risk of putting them up early. Okay. So d4x, what does that count here? Minus 4, because x is like 1 over m. Then plus 2 for the derivatives. And then plus 2 times whatever dimensions we set for h. Anybody want to do the algebra for me? 1. Who said 1? Somebody, I heard it in the back, a whisper. Anybody want this quarter? 50 years ago, you could get your hair cut for this. But we're not allowed to build time machines. Yeah, my notes say the dimension is 4. Yeah, you know, you prepare these things like from midnight to 1 a.m. Strange things happen. Okay, so now we can know the dimensions of some of these coupling constants. What's the dimension of lambda?
Zero.
Ah, anticipating the reward. It's a long way to toss it. Oh, this is an American quarter. It's got the state motto on for New Hampshire. Anybody know what it is? Live free or die, correct. A quarter for U.S. geography. Yeah, so lambda's dimensionless. What's the dimensions of V? It's got dimensions of mass. Okay, so let's say I wrote down this term. H, how am I doing time-wise? H dagger H cubed. Well, this is 2, 6, so I have to put something in front that goes like 1 over a mass scale squared. These interactions are called non-renormalizable because they have coupling constants that go up like 1 over a mass. They actually mean the theory is not renormalizable. You can't absorb the divergences in a finite number of terms. But even if it existed, there's something else about it. Let's say M was ginormous. Ginormous. M is the mass of an elephant. That's a big number. Well, that's quite ridiculous. Right? We don't want to do things bigger than the Planck mass. Let's say it's like 10 to the 15 times the proton mass, 10 to the 15 GeV. Well, if I do a low energy experiment, then this M is going to come in the denominator of some physical quantity like a cross section, and upstairs are going to be energies. So you'll get these energies divided by M, and it'll have a very small impact on the physics that we do. And so it's a very good approximation to start with, provided the scale M is large, to just focus on what are called renormalizable interactions, where none of the coupling constants go like 1 over a mass to some power. And that's what gets us down to a finite number of interactions. That's what gets us down to just these interactions here. They're the only ones that are local or normalizable, gauge invariant, yada, 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 interaction.
Sir, I didn't follow the argument why M should be large.
Okay, so M doesn't have to be large. So if M was only, so if M was not large, then this would just be the wrong theory. We wouldn't start here. We would see its effects right away. So the fact that this seems to be sufficient tells us that M is large. Because it's non-renormalizable, we know if we have a theory where we see these interactions, there's a more fundamental theory where we'd be able to absorb all the divergences that was described just in terms of renormalizable interactions or maybe some other structure like string theory, because we do have to be able to absorb any divergences into coupling constants, or have a theory without divergences would be even better. So it's really experiment that tells us the next M is bigger than something. And in fact, what people do, for example, they take LHC experiments, they add interactions by this, and they put limits on this M to understand how we're probing where the next physics might lie. And, you know, when they invented the four Fermi theory, I don't know what people really understood in Fermi's day, but after a certain point, people understood that can't be the fundamental theory, it wasn't renormalizable, and they started looking for the things that would give us that effective theory if we treated them as heavy, like the W and Z. Okay, so we got the interaction involving H. And I should write down for you now what this covariant derivative is in general, because we're going to use it a lot. So this covariant derivative, I got 1 minute. This is complete generality, how I'm going to write it. So here's the ordinary derivative. B goes from 1 to A. These are the SU3 color generators. So the generators depend on what representation it's acting on. And these are the SU2 generators. And this is the hypercharge. So if we're acting on the Higgs field, for example, if this covariant derivative is acting on this Higgs doublet, it's a two-component object, then we know what's going on. We know, for example, that the TBs are zero. So acting on the Higgs, I forget about this. It's a doublet, so the TAs are the Pauli matrices, sigma A divided by 2, and Y is equal to 1/2. So this is the covariant derivative in the case of acting on the Higgs. And when I add other particles, it'll take a different form. So acting on the Higgs, this object here is just d mu plus I g2 sigma a over 2 w mu a. These are the SU2 generators, as I said, plus I g1 over 2 b mu, and this is the hypercharge gauge boson. So we're going to use that covariant derivative next class. This is d mu. Let me say one more. Let me just mention one more thing. Classically, what you do is you find the configuration to minimize the energy, right? That's the ground state of the theory. And so you can see that classically we could minimize the energy by H having a constant value such that it canceled out this V squared. And then V would be equal to zero. Of course, I could have written any constant and added that here. In this class, that constant doesn't matter, but in the real world, it matters a lot. Anybody know why?
Cosmological constant.
That's right. Gravity feels all types of energy, even the energy of the ground state. Other things, all that matter is energy differences. So the fact that the ground state has some energy doesn't matter. So for cosmology, the value of this, called the cosmological constant, it's crucial. And it ends up having a really small value. Like this V here ends up being 250 times the proton mass, roughly, 246 times the proton mass. The cosmological constant, if I express it as something with at like a mass to the fourth power, that mass would be a thousandth of an electron volt, roughly. Experimentally measured from the measured expansion of the universe. So that's totally crazy, but that's the way it is. Not going to say much more about that in this class, but it's one of the most important puzzles of modern physics. It touches on both particle physics and relativity and cosmology. Okay, more next time. Sorry, I ran a little over. Oh, I have some. Yeah, today it ends up I have a committee meeting I have to Skype into, and I have to prepare for it. So if you want to come see me in the afternoon is when I'll be free. You can never avoid committee meetings. They'll hunt you down no matter where you are and make you Skype in.